We've got a very ambitious agenda right now to put people back on the moon sustainably.
Yeah.
We get asked, well, we went to the moon in the 60s and 70s. Why? What's the difference, right? Haven't we already done this? We went there last time to beat the other guy there. This time we're going there to stay. And that's a fundamentally different paradigm. And you got to think about getting up there and staying there a little bit differently. And then we're using it not only as a basis for scientific discovery and exploration, but then also as an analog to allow us to learn how to live and work further away from planet Earth here, so that maybe one day we can take people on to Mars or beyond. So that's a different way of looking at it, but that's the agency's ambitious agenda right now.
Let's discover what people are building in the greater Cleveland community. We are telling the stories of Northeast Ohio's entrepreneurs, builders, and those supporting them. Welcome to the Lay of the Land podcast, where we are exploring what people are building in Cleveland and throughout Northeast Ohio. I am your host, Jeffrey Stern, and today I had the genuine privilege of speaking with Dr. James Kenyon, director of NASA's Glenn Research Center here in Cleveland, Ohio. Founded back in 1941, Glenn Research Center has led NASA's electric propulsion development efforts and been integral in many of NASA's most famous missions, from Mercury and Apollo to the Space Shuttle and the International Space Station, playing important roles in robotic exploration missions, including the Mars rovers and Cassini's mission to Saturn. Today, with over 725 patents, Glenn is providing integral support to Artemis 1, NASA's mission to return us to the moon, overseeing the service module that will propel the Orion space capsule out of Earth's orbit and around the moon. With a budget of approximately $900 million and staff of more than 3,200 civil servants, Dr. Kenyon is responsible for planning, organizing, and directing the activities of Glenn in accordance with NASA's mandates. Prior to becoming Glenn's director, Dr. Kenyon served as the director of the Advanced Air Vehicles Program in the Aeronautics Research Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters in Washington. He led advanced programs and technology at Pratt & Whitney and worked for 17 years in the Department of Defense, where he was responsible for strategic planning, policy guidance, and management oversight of DoD aerospace science and technology programs. It is hard to overstate how fun this conversation was for me, tapping into my latent childhood love and curiosity for exploring the great cosmos around spaceship Earth. Dr. Kenyon and I explore his passion for aerospace and his path to NASA, the history and evolution of the Glenn Research Center and its significant impact here in Cleveland, Ohio, his reflections on leadership, decision-making, and on talent, and ultimately, what is on the horizon? No pun intended, for exploring the unknown in both air and in space. As a brief aside, this conversation was recorded earlier in the year prior to some of the future events Dr. Kenyon mentions at the time that have since transpired, like the illustrious eclipse I think that every Clevelander now deeply appreciates. So please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Jimmy Kenyon after a brief message from our sponsor. Lay of the Land is brought to you by John Carroll University's Bowler College of Business, widely recognized as one of the top business schools in the region. As we've heard time and time again from entrepreneurs here on Lay of the Land, many of whom are proud alumni of John Carroll University, success in this ever-changing world of business requires a dynamic and innovative mindset, deep understanding of emerging technologies and systems, strong ethics, leadership prowess, acute business acumen, all qualities nurtured through the Bowler College of Business. With four different MBA programs of study, spanning professional, online, hybrid, and one-year flexible, the Bowler College of Business provides flexible timelines and various class structures for each MBA track, including online, in-person, hybrid, and asynchronous, all to offer the most effective options for you, including the ability to participate in an elective international study tour, providing unparalleled opportunities to expand your global business knowledge by networking with local companies overseas and experiencing a new culture. The career impact of a Bowler MBA is formative and will help prepare you for this future of business and get more out of your career. To learn more about John Carroll University's Bowler MBA programs, please go to business.jcu.edu. The Bowler College of Business is fully accredited by AACSB International, the highest accreditation a college of business can have. Well, Jimmy, thank you for joining us today.
Excellent. Glad to be here.
So I was thinking about where the best place to start would be. And what came to mind was if NASA was to come up in conversation, and as people's minds naturally sort of drift to the greater cosmos beyond us and then begin thinking through the actual complexities of what it takes to build a vehicle that would allow us to safely traverse that frontier, I wouldn't imagine that Northeast Ohio, you know, comes to mind as this focal point of innovation in aeronautical research and electric propulsion and space energy, but apparently it should. Mm-hmm. And here we are.
Yep.
So I'd love to start with kind of that at a high level. You know, how is it that NASA Glenn came to be? What is the reason for being, and what is the work being done to support our exploration of the unknown in air and in space?
Sure. So NASA Glenn was founded in 1941. It was originally founded as part of the National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics, which preceded NASA. It was actually formed in the late 19-teens to really provide some sort of government guidance, some sort of government push for aeronautics and aviation. A big part of that was of course, World War II, and everything else was where aeronautics and aviation really started to take off. So the original center was the Langley Research Center, which is down in Hampton Roads. But the NACA continued to expand. And as we were coming into World War II, they were looking at this and they said, well, we need to do something in aircraft propulsion. Mm. That's going to be a driver for capability. The Germans were really pushing on that very hard. And so aircraft propulsion was something we were going to need to work on. And at that point, the second center, which was at Moffett Field, is the Ames Research Center, had been stood up. But only a year or two later, Glenn was formed specifically as the Aircraft Engine Research Lab under the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, the NACA. And that's what we did. The goal then was to advance aircraft propulsion technology to give our flyers the advantage in the skies during World War II as part of the World War II buildup. And so they developed and built capabilities for testing aircraft engines, testing them at altitude, developing performance, creating performance, and all of that to try to help out with that war effort. When you look back historically, you know, sometimes you get asked, well why Cleveland?
And sure.
Well, a couple of different reasons. First off, Cleveland was big in aviation at the day. Cleveland Airport was one of the most advanced in the world. It was the home of the world famous Cleveland Air Races. There's a great old photo of what is now the Glenn Research Center. It's got a kind of a semicircular shape to it. That was a big parking lot, jam packed with cars there for the air races. So we've got the aviation history.
Right. I mean, then, even the Wright brothers, not too far from here.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And on top of that, Cleveland, of course, has been a manufacturing hub with steel production and manufacturing. There's a huge World War buildup of manufacturing that needed to be there. And then the one other little nuance is that aircraft engines in those days looked a lot like automotive engines. They're piston engines, right? Mm-hmm. There are companies, the Allison Engine Company made diesel engines. They made locomotive engines. They made airplane engines. And so there is a nice synergy there as well. And so a lot of reasons why this was a good place to be. As I understand, it was competitive and Cleveland put a good foot forward.
Yeah.
But NASA or the NACA at the time decided to create the Aircraft Engine Research Lab right here and then develop that capability. Now, after World War II, we start to move into the jet age. We continued that work. The NACA Center moved into the jet age. And then in 1958, after the launch of the Sputnik by the Soviet Union, NASA was formed. The National Aeronautics and Space Act created NASA. What is now NASA took in the NACA and combined it all into one group. And of course, once we did that, then again, the capability transformed and started to look at going into space. But the focus has stayed the same in many, many ways. It's propulsion. We still work on advanced aircraft propulsion, including things like hybrid propulsion for hybrid electric propulsion systems for big aircraft, right? Electric propulsion systems for urban air taxis, these electric air taxis that could take off and land vertically and take people around major cities, right? We still work on those sorts of capabilities. We do propulsion for spacecraft. We don't make the big rockets, but once a spacecraft is outside of the Earth's atmosphere and is flying around, we work on the propulsion systems for that.
Yeah.
all of these things need power, and they go hand in hand. And so we work on power for aircraft. We work on power for spacecraft, and looking into the future, working on power for, say, the lunar surface. We've continued to advance. We've gotten into communications research, and we drive communications technology development for the agency, for NASA, and looking at what the future is going to be there as well. All of that requires materials. So we do a lot of work in advanced materials, but especially materials for extreme environments, for really, really hot things, because we're making engines and propulsion systems.
Right.
And we're making communications technologies. And then we also do things that are pretty extreme, like shape memory alloys for tires to go over a lunar surface, right? And then finally, we do a lot of work in terms of space environment testing. Which comes out of our propulsion work. We need to be able to simulate the altitudes to get the performance of the propulsion systems right. And so we've developed the capability to be able to do that on multiple scales for aircraft engines, be they conventional or electric, as well as for electric propulsion systems that might drive a spacecraft or a satellite on orbit.
Wow. It's incredible, the breadth of it. And I know we'll spend some time unpacking it. Before we do, though, I want to layer on a bit your own personal journey as part of this whole endeavor. You know, one of the fun things is through this podcast, a lot of the folks that I get to talk to who really are working on, you know, a plethora of problems from A2 Guernsey milk production to beer manufacturing to zinc battery storage to precision surgical tooling. A lot of them, when they reflect on their childhood and early life, did not imagine that they would be working on the problem that they are working on now. I think often drawn to the common answer to the question, what would you like to be when you grow up? And often, you know, it's around this exploring space in an astronaut sort of way. So you might be the first person on the podcast who, I don't know what you were contemplating when you were younger, but if that was your answer to that question. And so I'd love to just hear a little bit about your own path and where you're interest in all of this stems from.
So I was going to be a pro baseball player.
All right.
Then I was going to be a rock and roll star.
Yep.
And in both cases, ambition outran talent. Okay. So now what are you going to do? I grew up in the World War, or the Cold War, rather. I grew up in the Cold War. We watched the movies, Top Gun, of course. Iron Eagle was a favorite of mine because I happen to like Air Force airplanes a little bit more than those big wings on the F-14s. But grew up in the Cold War. I wanted to fly fast jets.
Yeah.
I grew up in the country. You would see near a big lake with a dam, and the pilots would come and fly exercises every now and again near the dam, and you'd see them fly over fast and low, and I wanted to fly fast jets. Unfortunately, I found out that in high school that I was not going to be able to do that. I was medically disqualified. But so what are you going to do? Well, by that time, I already knew I wanted to be an aerospace engineer. I loved things that fly. I love watching airplanes go overhead. That's what I wanted to do. I didn't know what an aerospace engineer was. I just knew they worked on airplanes.
Yeah.
And I also knew that engineers tended to get jobs and could make money. So that was a good thing, right? So you can get a job. And so that was my motivation. As luck would have it, I grew up in the state of Georgia. The public school, technical school there happened to be one of the best in the world at Georgia Tech. And so I went to Georgia Tech. I learned what it meant to be an aerospace engineer. And I've done it basically ever since then. I love everything about it. Now, talk about what we do at Glenn in propulsion.
Well,
it's funny. I was not studying propulsion. I was studying composite materials and structures for helicopter blades or spacecraft or whatever. But then I went through a program called co-op, cooperative education, where you alternate work and school terms and you actually work for a company for some period of time. And sometimes it's better to be lucky than good. They stuck me in propulsion. And at the time it felt like stuck me in propulsion.
Yeah.
But down there, they actually let me work on things. And I would walk by jet engines being built and I'm trying to figure out what I'm looking at. And just that struck me. And I kind of enjoyed it, really liked it. I love the smell of jet fuel in the morning. And I mean that.
Yeah.
And I
believe you.
Yeah. And but as I was coming out and looking for jobs, I got a call from the Air Force Research Laboratory in Dayton. They were considering me. Well, the guy told me on the phone they were considering me for a couple of jobs. One was composite structures, one was propulsion. And they ended up picking me for propulsion. And the rest, as they say, is history. I worked in propulsion at Wright-Patterson for Air Force Research Lab spent some time in the Pentagon working on a lot more than propulsion, but propulsion was part of my portfolio. Went off after that, left the government for a little while, worked for a jet engine manufacturer, and then came back to the government at NASA headquarters. Again, the portfolio was bigger than propulsion, but propulsion was in it. And then I got the phone call that was asking me to come up and spend a little time in Cleveland at Glenn. And of course, we do a lot more than just propulsion, but our focus largely is propulsion.
Yeah.
And so it's been a wonderful journey as part of the propulsion. We've sometimes just called it the propulsion mafia. You know, once you're in, you know, you can try to get out, but they keep pulling you back in. Yeah. That certainly has been reflective of my career. So,
well, I think it might have been at the Greater Cleveland Partnership where you had done your keynote address. And I think I heard you describe in the context of Glenn that you can kind of capture it as once you get into space, then what?
That's right.
That's really the focus and crux of the work that you're doing at this point.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And you poked at it a little bit earlier, but you know, one of the things and one of the reasons why we're not maybe as recognizable to many is because we work on the things we work on. Nothing flies without propulsion, power, and communications, which is what we do. So we're involved in everything NASA does. But when you look at a spacecraft, you're not looking for the propulsion system. And when you look at an airplane, you're not looking at the engines hanging off the wings. So we're not the first thing you think about, but you're not flying without us.
Right. And it's so requisite.
That's right. That's right.
So I think, you know, we could spend many hours talking about all the different kinds of technologies involved, but I'd pose just at a high level, what do you feel are, in the history of Glenn, kind of the most salient and exciting accomplishments? And then with an eye towards the future, you know, the most powerful implications of the research being done today.
Yeah. Well, I can give you my impressions, and I've got 3,200 people who would give you a different impression of what the most salient accomplishments were, many of them that they accomplished. Glenn really pushed jet engine technology early on for military as well as for civilian. And in fact, Glenn, as you probably know, if you follow the aerospace industry, the single aisle market is undergoing a huge revitalization. They're putting engines on these airplanes that are 15 to 17% more efficient. Hmm. That's operating costs, that's fuel burn, that's emissions. Look at it in whatever lens you want to look at it. That's goodness. NASA was part of that. NASA worked with the engine companies developing those technologies that are going into that. And NASA drove at the early stages of some of those technologies, the advancement that allowed those companies to take it on. I think that's a huge, but it goes back before this latest iteration. It goes all the way back to the dawn of the jet age. And even before that, NASA's really contributed to aviation and the advancement of aviation for our nation.
Yeah.
When it comes to spacecraft, a lot of work in the early parts of the programs with Centaur. We've touched everything from Mercury to Gemini and on to Apollo. We've been part of all of those with various parts that we've been able to supply. It's a great thing to know that you were part of that. And whether it's the materials that we've developed, we've tested a lot of those propulsion systems, the upper stage rockets we've tested in our facilities, and now with satellite technologies, we've driven the development of the thrusters that are now flying on all of our satellites. And so it's when you think about how much we depend on satellites for communications, whether it's your satellite radio or watching a football game on a Sunday afternoon, we depend on that. And we just take it for granted. But somebody invented that and worked on that. And a lot of that technology came out of Glenn. So it's a neat thing to reflect back on.
Yeah, I mean, it's all fascinating. In the context of all that, one of the things I was curious about is how you think about risk. Mm-hmm. Knowing that at a high level, you know, NASA kind of manages an R&D budget that, you know, kind of dwarfs even many public companies, you know, ability to invest in that kind of research and development under this umbrella of propulsion, energy, and communications. The amount of things that you could research, I'm at, is endless. And so What is the process through which that you think through, you know, the opportunity costs of exploring one path over another, and just the kind of higher level thinking around strategy, if you will, with regards to research? And, you know, at the end of the day, where the expectation is, we're going to try and ship something, you know, into the air and in outer space.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing. And one of the things, because I've spent my whole career in research and development, and one of the things that I've learned is to never say never. I've eaten those words a couple of times because you have really smart people doing incredible work. But what you have to look at is you have to take a step back and kind of place yourself in the context of what's going on in the world. You know what technologies were developing and what things were advancing, and you can go out and talk to your researchers and they'll give you a dissertation on why it's important and what it does and everything else. But then you have to kind of take a step back, blur your eyes. But there are so many things that go into how we look at our strategy and how we think about our strategy. One of them is embedded in the agency strategy. We've got a very ambitious agenda right now to put people back on the moon sustainably.
Yeah.
We get asked, well, we went to the moon in the 60s and 70s. Why? What's the difference, right? Haven't we already done this? We went there last time to beat the other guy there. This time we're going there to stay. And that's a fundamentally different paradigm. And you got to think about getting up there and staying there a little bit differently. And then we're using it not only as a basis for scientific discovery and exploration, but then also as an analog to allow us to learn how to live and work further away from planet Earth here, so that maybe one day we can take people on to Mars or beyond. Hmm. So that's a different way of looking at it. But that's the agency's ambitious agenda right now. It's a bold agenda. And so what does that mean in terms of the kinds of things that we're doing and how do we advance that? By the same token, what's going on in the world with our other part of our market, aviation, there's a real drive toward sustainability. And like I mentioned before, it's good for our planet. It's good from an emission standpoint, climate change, pollution, but it's also a business decision. If you can burn 15 to 20% less fuel or 30% less fuel, that's operating cost right there. Yep. And that turns into and translates into ticket prices for people. That's a driver. And so how can we catalyze that? How can we advance that and help support our industry to be able to do that and then lean a little bit further in than maybe they could do on their own. Mm. So looking at sort of the macro, what's going on in the world? Where are you going? Going back to space, there's this, we're talking about going to the moon and Mars, but you've got a commercial industry now with some new players who weren't there just a handful of years ago. SpaceX and Blue Origin come to mind especially, but there are others as well. And you're seeing a lot more private investment because there's a market there. The years of work and discovery that NASA have done, whether directly or indirectly, have reduced risk, have paved the way, have allowed us to understand what it takes to fly in space, especially in orbit.
Yeah.
So the companies can now look at it because companies have worked beside us. They build the rockets, they build the satellites, so they are learning too. And so when you look at all of that and you think about what's going on in aviation, our strategy to go to the moon and Mars and what's going on in the commercial space market, you say, okay, so what is our role? What is our niche? Where can we make the biggest impact? And that's where you focus. You put that alongside, well, what are our core competencies? Well, everything needs power. Everything needs propulsion. Everything needs communications. What are the needs going to be in that larger architecture? For example, here coming up soon, we're going to be launching commercial payload services to the moon. It's a part of what we call our commercial lunar payload services project. They're going to be putting commercial companies launching landers to the moon. And then there's a vision that companies will eventually be able to create a business case for putting their technologies, their capabilities, whether it's manufacturing or other things on the moon. That's not going to happen if they don't have a power infrastructure.
Yeah.
So what do we need for a power infrastructure? So we've got people looking at, well, what does that mean? What are the power levels? What are the right technologies that are scalable so that you can build up to that? But you got to do it at a reasonable scale first or we'll never be able to afford it. You can't, you know, boil the ocean in one shot, you know? And so you got to be able to figure out how to do that. And, but that means that, well, scalability has got to be part of your strategy as well. And so that's how you feed into that strategy development is thinking through, what are those needs looking at the macro scale? What are those places where industry may not be able to go off and do it on their own? They need government help, government direction, even sometimes just government guidance and thought leadership. we can help with that, and we can help with the risk equation. And then where does that align with our competencies? Mm. It can be straight aligned or an adjacency, an offshoot of our competencies where we can contribute to that equation.
Yeah. I'd love to go a little deeper on this relationship between, you know, the work NASA's doing and the private sector work, mm-hmm. and knowing that the perception of, you know, SpaceX 2 decades ago as a fledgling company maybe was not taken as seriously as it is today, and the evolution of the role and the opportunity for startups who, you know, again, in the context of just this podcast, you know, typically operating at a much smaller scale, much earlier stage of their existence as an organization, where the opportunity is for those kinds of entrepreneurs with ambitions to positively contribute and impact space and all the work that's being done, and where, on the flip side of that, where the government needs to take the risk.
Right. Right. We looked at this. I was part of an interagency group that looked at these sorts of things a number of years ago. And one of the questions we asked was, what is the appropriate role of government in research and development? Obviously, national security is one because, okay, fine. Another, though, is public good. It's where there's an overarching benefit to the public that the government needs to drive. And maybe commercial industry can get there on their own, but the business isn't going to drive them there without somebody guiding and leading and incentivizing, right? And so public good is another one. And then another one gets into places where there's an economic opportunity, an opportunity to spur our industry, our U.S. industry, to lead. But the risk may be too high for a company president to walk into the boardroom and ask for the investment. And that's also a place where it can be an appropriate role of NASA to work on the technical risk, especially if we can drive it for the industry and not for this company or that company, but we can drive it for the U.S. industry to be able to advance. So those are some of the key roles that you look at. Now, that applies across the board. Those are the majors, those are the supply chain, that's the startups. But how do you specifically, because you're kind of asking, well, what if you're one of these startups and venture, how do you get involved? It's interesting. There are a couple of things, and Glenn is really good at this. We help to lead the agency in terms of technology transfer and engaging with small businesses. One way is that we have an active intellectual property portfolio. Our researchers invent things, and they patent them.
Yeah.
Well, why would a government patent it? You can't really draw royalties. Well, not a lot of royalties, but why would you, the government, ever patent something? Well, the idea is to create intellectual property that we can work with companies to look at and to see that opportunity and to use. And so a lot of what we do is non-exclusive. So you have a right to use this invention for your application. Your application is your proprietary information, it's your data, it's your concept, you own it. But that fundamental technology you are incorporating, you don't own. And this company over here can use that for a different application. And so it creates an opportunity. So we have an active intellectual property portfolio. It contains anything from sensors to measure things to communications, waveforms and technologies that you can do for communications to advanced materials, material chemistries and material production properties and techniques and things like that. And so one of the things that we can do is get out, work with small businesses, work with startups, work with some of the entities we have in Cleveland, like Nottingham Spurk and Jumpstart that support these incubators on how to get the word out about our innovation portfolio so that these companies can see what's there. They can license it. We have very favorable terms on the licensing for startups. We don't even charge for a research license to evaluate the technology. We don't even charge any sort of a licensing fee. It's given to them free for up to 3 years to go figure out how they would apply it and use it. So that's one way. And we have we've got a strategy laid out and we hold events to try to do that. But we also work directly with companies that come and engage and talk with us. Another way is through a much larger government program called Small Business Innovation Research. And the idea is, how can we engage small businesses, including startups, to bring their innovation? Very favorable intellectual property terms. It's a government contract, but very favorable intellectual property terms. There's an offshoot of that called Small Business Technology Transfer, where the business needs to partner with a university as well. But again, very similar terms. But it starts off with a phase one award that says, go do some concept development and bring us back something that looks promising. And if that starts to pan out and looks good, you can compete for and win a phase two. And that can be up to $1 million. The phase one is, I think, $150,000 or $200,000 now. And don't quote me on the numbers, because when I first engaged, it was a much lower number, but I know that the numbers have increased, and I'm trying to remember exactly where they are now. But the phase two is a bit more lucrative, because now you're actually going to go build something and test it, right? And try it out.
Yeah.
And then you've got an opportunity that you can turn into a business. And this is your concept with a little bit of government funding. It's a little bit tougher to get, because we put out topic areas, but companies can engage with the government. They can engage with NASA. They can engage with NASA Glenn and talk about areas where they think there's innovation, and where we see, especially if we start to see multiple places, or we have big companies saying, hey, I need something that looks a little bit like this.
Yeah.
We can put out topics where people can bid against them and develop their ideas into viable products. And we've seen success stories there. And we've seen companies start there and grow into mid-sized companies. We've seen companies start there and become suppliers to primes. We've seen companies start there and get bought by the primes. So there's a whole lot of different models, but these are opportunities for people to bring their innovation forward and get support for them so that they can turn it into a product that goes somewhere someday.
Lay of the Land is brought to you by Impact Architects and by 90. As we share the stories of entrepreneurs building incredible organizations in Cleveland and throughout Northeast Ohio, Impact Architects has helped hundreds of those leaders, many of whom we have heard from as guests on this very podcast, realize their own visions and build these great organizations. I believe in Impact Architects and the people behind it so much that I have actually joined them personally in their mission to help leaders gain focus, align together, and thrive by doing what they love. If you too are trying to build great, Impact Architects is offering to sit down with you for a free consultation or provide a free trial through 90, the software platform that helps teams build great companies. If you're interested in learning more about partnering with Impact Architects or by leveraging 90 to power your own business, please go to ia.layoftheland.fm. The link will also be in our show notes.
From your vantage point, you know, with a full awareness of, you know, across propulsion, power, communications, if you could issue a request for startups, where you would love to see, you know, entrepreneurs focus time, attention, resources, are there pockets where there's a dearth, you know, from the government side where you'd love to see people kind of try and fill that void?
One that never gets old is materials. There's always a need for higher strength, higher temperature, more capable, more durable materials. That can be at small scales for some applications. It can be for at large scales. And then being able to get to those with a domestic supply chain. There are certain materials that aren't available in the U.S., but if your technology depends on them, now we're dependent on a foreign supply chain, some of them not necessarily in friendly parts of the world. So those sorts of things. Energy storage, energy production, energy storage. How can you move energy around? That's related to that. It's a place where, you know, domestic supply chains are hard, but there's always a drive for smaller, lighter weight, higher power capabilities. The safety that goes with that. How do we make sure that, for example, batteries flying on airplanes are safe? If you've got ideas, that's not a bad thing to have. And so those are a couple of areas. When we start thinking about things like urban air taxis, electric vertical takeoff and landing vehicles, and we call it advanced air mobility. But these are things that can fly a couple of passengers, 50 or 100 or 200 nautical miles, do it all electric. Now you're getting into maybe small motors or the components for small electric motors. Some of those can be hard to come by. And so there's a lot of interesting ideas on ways to do those sorts of things. Now, people think of all sorts of other things. Sensor technologies for health management has always been something that has advanced and has seen a lot of advancement from small businesses. Manufacturing techniques that large companies can use to expand their manufacturing or accelerate their manufacturing. So there are a lot of different things.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
When you talk about some of what feels to me on the periphery of sci-fi and sci-fact, you know, with vertical takeoff and landing and these kind of electric air vehicles, I'll pull in one of the perennial points of conversation with folks in the area, which is, you mentioned over 3,000 folks at the facility. Where are these people coming from? When you think about talent and retention, what is the philosophy from NASA's perspective about how to recruit and retain and possibly even train up folks who don't even work at NASA, but could work at the complementary organizations, some of these enterprises that are working with NASA?
Right. Well, there are multiple parts of this, right? One is our own recruiting and retention. And we really try to go out and engage universities. We try to engage in different events and conferences. We have our processes that we need to follow. We're a government agency. We have to be open. We have to be equitable and fair. But the key becomes, how do you get people then to see that and to apply? We do spend some time and focus on organizations such as the National Society of Black Engineers, the Society of Hispanic Professional Engineers, the Engineering Society for Indigenous Americans, and other groups, Society of Women Engineers, Women in Aerospace, various groups that try to work on diversity. Diversity is a big part of that. The more people we have with different backgrounds and different perspectives gives us different ways to look at problems and solve them. We need that. We're solving the hardest problems in the world, the hardest problems that physics can throw at us. We need as many different perspectives and ideas as we can get, and diversity is how you get to that. And so we take that very seriously in our recruiting efforts, and we go out and engage like that. So part of it is the recruiting, and then part of it is the pipeline. Because when you go out recruiting, you need people to recruit. And it starts early. We work STEM engagement activities. We've got an activity that we did this past summer. We worked with a couple of our community supporters, the Ohio Aerospace Institute and the Aerozone Alliance, which are business advocacy groups and working in aerospace here in Cleveland. And we worked with them in a partnership with the Cleveland Metropolitan School District to create opportunities for up to a couple of dozen students from CMSD to come out and have a summer experience, much like an internship at Glenn. That is a way to do that.
That's awesome.
We also, we have a robust internship program with multiple ways to get there. And typically in a summer, we'll host somewhere on the order of 150 interns at Glenn during the summer. And some of them get into a program that rotates them and brings them back over and over. And so we'll have 30 or 40 interns at a time, even when it's not the summer. And so that's an incredible part of our pipeline. Those are people who know us. They're working on problems that are similar to us. And we can recruit a lot of those. Our contractors who work with us on site recruit a lot of those. And many of those, even if we don't recruit them and retain them, they end up in our suppliers, in the companies that work with us, the companies that are building spacecraft, the companies that are building aircraft and engines. So it's a good tool to catalyze the pipeline, not just for NASA, but for the aerospace community. So we do that. We partner with universities, Ohio State, University of Cincinnati, Case Western, Cleveland State, and a number of other universities to also work on research projects together. And when we're doing that, we're engaging professors, we're engaging students, and that's part of building that pipeline too.
Oh, that's very cool. So all in, what does success mean to you? You know, what is the impact that you hope to have in retrospect?
Well, so there are a lot of ways to ask that question. And one is, well, as Glenn, right? And to me, I see Glenn, I sometimes talk about Glenn as the utility company for the agency, the utility company for NASA.
Yeah.
Power, propulsion, communication, right? Success to me is that Glenn is providing the best that we can to enable NASA's missions. And that we're doing it in such a way that the agency is coming to us to manage stuff, to lead stuff, to drive things, because they know when you come to Glenn, you're going to get it done. That is success to me from a mission standpoint, that we're delivering and enabling NASA's missions and making NASA's mission successful. From a community engagement standpoint, we're working with our companies to build a community around us where our people want to live and work. That it's a great community, a vibrant community where their families are and they are and they want to be here, and people around the agency want to be here because this is a great place to live and work. And then for our people, which to me is the biggest and most important thing. It's about fulfillment, right? At the end of the day, do you feel like you came in and made an impact? You made a difference. NASA people really, really are passionate about the mission. They want to make a difference. And so if I can create an environment where they can come in and feel like they have an opportunity to make a difference and they're motivated and inspired and they make a difference, then I'm doing my job. And I can go home feeling fulfilled at the end of the day.
What is the most challenging part of the work that you do?
Keeping up with my calendar, to be very frank with you. It's time. It's time. There are more things that I want to do, that I think we can do, than there are hours in the day to do it. There are lots of resource constraints. If we had a bunch more people, we could probably do more faster. If we had a bunch more facilities, we could do a bunch more faster. But we're a government agency. We work through the budget process. We advocate to cover the mission and get things done. But at the end of the day, even advocating for those resources takes time. And so it's such an exciting mission. I just want to do more. And the biggest constraint that I don't have any way of getting more of is time.
Right. The only strictly waning resource.
That's right.
What do you wish more people understood about the work you're doing that they don't?
I think the biggest thing that I would like for people to understand about it, well, two things. One is that it does impact their lives. And we talked a little bit about it. You know, satellites today are there because of some of the work that our people have done over the decades. But we depend on them so much. The communication technologies like your phone, that was worked on by people who were working communications technologies and developing that. And yes, very innovative companies have figured out how to put these into practice and make markets out of them. But that technology started somewhere. We're doing research to figure out how to cure cancer. We're doing research to understand how radiation impacts people. We're doing research to understand how our climate is changing and forming and evolving in our planet. We're doing research that is really impacting people's lives, whether it's the air quality around them or the water quality or the economic availability of things and goods and services that they enjoy.
Yeah.
That's one thing. The other thing, and especially for those who are a little bit younger, is that, and by the way, you can do this too. Mm. These are human beings, just like everybody else walking around the city of Cleveland in Northeast Ohio. These are human beings who grew up, they were kids, they had dreams, they were passionate about math and science and how things work, and they went off and they learned a little bit about it, and now they're scientists and engineers who are literally coming in, rewriting laws of physics and changing the world. But they're just normal human beings like you. And so you can be part of this too.
Yeah. I love both those sentiments. I think it's, to me, it feels really important to stress that idea that it's so hard at the onset to discern what the future implications of the research you're doing today are, but every technology that we use, you know, from these mics depended on some research in the past that, and the implications of which you just can't really know. But the lesson is that research is important.
That's right. But research is done by regular people. I grew up on a farm in South Georgia. Okay. I worked in peanut fields. I worked with pigs and cattle. And here I am at NASA Glenn, you know, and I've seen things and done things. I've watched launches go off. I've watched jet engines be tested. I've been upside down in the backseat of an F-16, and I have a 9G pin that I earned. But I'm a kid who grew up in a small town in South Georgia and worked on a farm. And so, yeah, you can do it. Hmm.
Well, I know there's a million things we can still talk about here. Of the things that we have talked about, are there things that we haven't talked about that you feel are particularly important that you would like to call attention to? You know, in reflection on both your personal journey leading NASA Glenn and just more broadly the nature of the work that you're doing there.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the future.
Yeah.
And where things are going.
Absolutely.
We talked some about the agency's vision to go to the moon and then on to Mars. There's a lot of exciting stuff happening. next week on Monday, well, Monday in the wee hours of the morning, so whether you call it Sunday night or Monday morning, we're launching what we call the Peregrine 1. It's a commercial lunar payload services. It's a lander that's being developed or was developed by a company in Pittsburgh called Astrobotic. NASA is buying payloads and integrating payloads on that. It's a commercial launch. It's a commercial company doing commercial things, but NASA's going to get a ride on it. And that's kind of a cool thing.
Yeah.
And in February, Intuitive Machines is going to launch their first lander to the moon. So we're going to have companies putting landers and things on the moon that in the future, we're going to be able to use. When we put people on the moon, they're going to have stuff there to work with. That's kind of a cool thing. But those launches are starting next week. We're getting ready for Artemis 2. Artemis 1 launched a little over a year ago, took the first human-rated spacecraft to the moon since 1972. It did a nice loop around the moon, got some great imagery, came back. It was a test flight. We tested a lot of systems on it, and we are learning a ton from it. This is helping us to improve and get ready for the next launch. Well, the spacecraft, the Orion capsule that went around the moon and that will carry humans when we go back, is currently on a truck on its way to Armstrong Test Facility in Sandusky. It should be here early next week, and we're going to do environmental testing to make sure that that spacecraft is ready to take humans.
Yeah.
There are parts of the flight envelope we didn't test last time because we weren't going to need it. We're going to test those parts of the flight envelope now, and that's going to be happening in the next coming weeks and months. So that's an exciting thing right here in Northeast Ohio. Another part of our Moon to Mars agenda is building a space station that's going to orbit the moon. Just think about the flexibility that's going to give to allow people, the staging people to go to the surface, staging stuff to bring back to Earth. It's going to be awesome. We are providing the thrusters, the propulsion system that will allow that space station to stay on orbit around the moon. We start qualification testing at Glenn here early this year.
Yeah.
So another big milestone that's happening right here. Next week, I'm going out for the rollout of the X-59. It's going to be NASA's first X-plane to make it to flight, manned X-plane to make it to flight in a very long time. We're going to do the rollout. You'll get to see the airplane with its paint job. It's pretty slick. And that's going to be an important stage as we start ramping up into the ground testing that will eventually lead to the first flight. But we're going to do the rollout next week. So a lot of big, exciting things coming up in the next weeks and months. And then a big one that everybody in Cleveland ought to be tracking is the eclipse.
Mm, yeah.
April 8th, I think my fact finders and historians found that the last time an eclipse found any part of Ohio was 1806, 3 years after the state was founded.
Wow.
Right. And 1806, this is the first one since then, and it is going right over Northeast Ohio and Cleveland. And it's a rare thing to have an eclipse go over your community. It's an even more rare thing to have an eclipse go over a NASA center. And so this is going to be a really cool opportunity to connect our community with, you know, people connect with space when they see the eclipse, and to connect that in our community with NASA is a huge opportunity. And so April the 8th, and we're going to have a big festival downtown. Or actually, it's going to be a 3-day festival. We're going to have a NASA village right out in front of the Great Lakes Science Center where we host our visitor center. We're going to have a stage set up. We're going to have performances, including science demonstrations. We're going to have speakers. We're going to have a lot of guests. We're anticipating senior leadership from NASA headquarters is going to be there. And I'll certainly be spending a lot of time there as well. And so we're just excited about that and see a huge opportunity there to engage our community in what we're doing. So,
wow, that's amazing.
Some exciting things coming up here in the very near future.
Well, I imagine when you reflect on one of those pillars of success to you, which is the fulfillment of the people that you get to work with, I can't imagine that's a very difficult one because the work you're doing is so inspiring and so ambitious and just so important. It's very cool to hear about. So I'll bookend it here with our traditional closing question, which is unrelated to anything we've talked about, but is for your favorite hidden gem in the area, in Cleveland and Northeast Ohio, something that other folks should know about that maybe they don't.
Well, that's an interesting question. And I will start with, I have been at Glenn for a little over a year and officially moved here with my family less than a year ago.
Yeah.
So we're still relatively new to the area.
Well, welcome.
And I can tell you that that's tough because there are so many things, and some of them not so hidden. You know, I love the metro parks. I love the trails. I'm a runner, or maybe that's an overstatement, but I work real hard at it. Yeah. And just the trails and even running in the city is such a beautiful thing. Our waterfront and our lake and its different moods, it's neat to experience
it's
that.
It's pretty magical. Yeah.
It is. It really is. Those aren't exactly hidden, though. But a couple of things that maybe are a little less obvious, when I think of hidden gems, I start of the places that where you connect with people, and often that's over a meal. Mm. And so probably one of my favorites is Boss Chicken and Beer. Why do I say that? Well, I have celiac disease, so I have to stay away from gluten. I have to be gluten-free. And yeah. And that can be hard because there's a lot of things with wheat and barley and rye and things like that. But Boss Chicken and Beer has a very... very good gluten-free menu and excellent food. And it's a funky little place. They've got a few locations around. I always go to the one in Berea.
Yeah, yeah.
They're on Front Street. And so that's one of my favorite hidden gems. Right down the street's a place called Cornerstone Brewery. It's really hard to get good gluten-free beer. That's a place where you can get good gluten-free beer and a good gluten-free menu. And then I would say one more, because you asked for one, but I can't do just one, but is... Big Mouth Bakery in Rocky River, gluten-free donuts. And right around Easter time, they'll have punchkis. And so it's nice. It's kind of a cool thing. So just funny how they all come back to food for me, but that's okay. One of the cool things about Cleveland is as far as food and culture, and those two things go so hand in hand, this is a great place where you can find that. And so it's an awesome city. I'm sure all your listeners know that, but but I'm going to state the obvious. This is just an incredible city.
Yeah. Well, Jimmy, I just want to thank you for coming on, sharing a little bit more about your story, the work you're doing. Genuinely, it's really inspiring. And hopefully, you know, many more will be aware of it. And if they wanted to get involved or learn more or anything else, where would you direct them?
I would start with NASA.gov and go exploring and learn about our mission. We're part of a big agency that's doing incredible things. And then from NASA.gov, you can find all you want to find about Glenn. That's a good place to start. And then there are ways you can find to reach out and to engage in some of our programs and projects from there.
Amazing. Well, thank you again.
Excellent. Thanks so much.
That's all for this week. Thank you for listening. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show. So if you have any feedback, please send over an email to jeffrey@layoftheland.fm or find us on Twitter @podlayoftheland or @sternjefe, J-E-F-E. If you or someone you know would make a good guest for our show, please reach out as well and let us know. And if you enjoy the podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or on your preferred podcast player. Your support goes a long way to help us spread the word and continue to bring the Cleveland founders and builders we love having on the show. We'll be back here next week at the same time to map more of the land. The Lay of the Land podcast was developed in collaboration with the Up Company LLC. At the time of this recording, unless otherwise indicated, we do not own equity or other financial interests in the company which appear on this show. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of any entity which employs us. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.